listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Jessica Alexander arrived in Rwanda in 2003, the country was still struggling in the aftermath of the 1994 genocide 9 years earlier. She was an idealistic intern, eager to join the international humanitarian aid community, but what she found there was very different from what she'd imagined. In a memoir called Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid, she traces her personal journey from naive newcomer to a hopeful but critical realist. It's published by Broadway Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jessica Alexander to our show today.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
You've worked for various NGOs and UN agencies in some of the most troubled locations around the world. What got you thinking about becoming a humanitarian aid worker in the first place?
Well, during college, I had interned at a number of social service agencies, but domestically. And so I'd always been interested in, you know, working on issues that affected people who were less fortunate or, you know, coming from different places than I was. But I didn't really even know that this kind of work existed when I was in college. And it was only after some personal circumstances that I became really interested in combining my desire to have a meaningful profession with also my love of travel and adventure.
What had you been doing before you decided to make this career change?
Well, right after college, I actually worked in the private sector, and I write about that a little bit in the book, my experiences doing marketing for some fun brands. But, you know, after my mom passed away, actually, I decided I really wanted to get back into that kind of social service career. So,
and how did your father and friends react when you said you wanted to go to Africa and help change the world?
Right. Well, I think I definitely put some gray hairs on my father's head and some more wrinkles on his face. But, you know, they've sort of become acclimated to the fact that this is what I do. And, you know, my father is, as I write in the book, visited me in some troubled spots. And so I think they've understood that it's not that scary, and you can have a somewhat normal life there.
And he's also a doctor. He wants to, at least in theory, help people as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
You have some pretty detailed descriptions of what happened to you. Did you keep journals or other records?
Yeah. There were a lot of very lonely nights in some of these places where you're really isolated and your only friend is pen and paper. And so I would record a lot of what happened. And that was really helpful when I was writing the book because it helped me conjure up some details and stories that I would have otherwise forgotten.
You write about a sense of frustration that many aid workers feel.
Yeah.
What are they frustrated by?
Well, I think the enormity of the situation in which we're dropped into can be overwhelming. And, you know, I make this analogy in my book where it's sort of like a trick candle. You think you're like blowing it out and then it just keeps popping up again. So you think you've fixed something somewhere and another problem happens another place. And so it's easy to get frustrated, overwhelmed, and a feeling of burnout.
And you suggest that you pick up and leave before problems are solved because something else has popped up.
Yeah. You know, some people stay in countries for many years. That wasn't my path. And I'm, you know, open about that in the book as well. But I think in some of these places, there really isn't a clear end point either. And so you never feel like I've solved this problem or the problems that we're addressing have been finally fixed because they're recurring and it's very slow to kind of see that kind of outcome that you hope to happen.
Have you burnt your bridges in writing this book? Will any NGO be willing to hire you after they read it?
Oh, I hope not. I mean, I hope they do hire me. I hope I haven't burnt bridges. But I was very careful not to put in agency names, and that was an intentional thing because it wasn't to name or shame any one agency. I don't think I'm highly critical of any organization. I'm just open about some of the real challenges that we all face, and I think any aid worker or any agency reading this can identify with those. So I want to continue working in this field, and I hope I haven't burned bridges.
Well, you're not the first person to criticize these NGOs and the UN for some of the mistakes that they make, and yet they continue to make the mistakes.
Mm. Well, Sure.
You almost feel like there are institutional issues there.
There are institutional issues, but I don't think that that's the story. Sure, on a macro level, there's some problems, and there are things that people on at the global level are addressing. But on the micro level, there are individual stories. There are people whose lives have been really touched and affected positively by aid. And that's what I also wanted to show, is that, yes, it can be overwhelming. And sometimes from afar, it's easy to critique aid. But we're working under really intense and challenging, complex places. But, you know, children are back in school in a lot of places that we work. Nutritional rates have gotten better. Children who, you know, weren't able to get out of bed because they were so malnourished have been able, or, you know, you go back in and they're walking around and doing just fine. And so there, on a micro level, there are tons of stories where there have been really positive outcomes.
You'll also forgive me if during the course of this conversation I point out some of the negative things.
Sure.
What was the situation in Rwanda when you arrived? Were an intern?
I was an intern. So this was my debut into the aid world, where I sort of cut my teeth. And it was 9 years after the genocide. And remarkably, the country was functioning, you know, very well.
The genocide was not still an open sore?
Not really. I mean, at that point, and Rwanda is doing remarkably well today. What was still happening, though, were there were a ton of refugees who were now coming back to Rwanda. And the agency that I was working for was trying really hard to respond to that. I mean, I think in some places there were 23,000 refugees coming back from Tanzania. But what's one problem that we faced was that, you know, aid funding tends to move on to the next big disaster. And so the funding for this agency was being cut down and cut back because Iraq was happening, Afghanistan was happening, and donors' attention shifted there. But the needs within Rwanda to still address these crises, which, by the way, you know, can be for decades after, were still ongoing, but we were operating on a budget that would suggest that the problems were over.
Now, you were a student.
I was
still
a student.
Yeah. Had your classes and professors prepared you for what you were going to find?
Sure. But, you know, as anything, it's, you know, the classroom is much different than when you're on the ground facing it.
You were told you had to find your own living accommodations.
Yeah.
Now, you found unorthodox accommodations, and you were criticized for it?
I wasn't criticized. I was more, I think my colleagues were a bit shocked because I was living with a local Rwandan family, and they all lived in very large, nice expat homes with guards and functioning electricity and running water.
And servants.
They did have maids and cooks, and I don't think that that's unusual in these contexts.
Could you have afforded to live that way?
Not at that time, no. I was on a very measly intern budget.
One surprising aspect of your book is your description of the parties that aid workers throw in their compounds. How often are those parties, which can get rather wild, thrown?
Well,
like it's like college kids on a break.
It can sound like that, but you know, I think the point is that we're all working under really intense, challenging environments and circumstances, and partying is just a way to, or having a drink with colleagues is a way to, it's a coping mechanism, it's a way to unwind. And you know, those people having parties, and I was one of them, they may have just worked 3 weeks in a row, back to back to back, 100-hour weeks. And so it's a way to let off steam. And I think it's a way to also deal with what's going on around you. And in a respectful way, I mean, no one's going out and partying it up, you know, in front of the people that were there to help. I mean, it's done in a quiet, respectful way. And I think that, you know, it's okay.
What is janjaweed juice?
Janjaweed juice, that is a locally fermented alcohol drink that was actually produced by the locals there in Darfur. And it was something that, you know, it looks like water. And I remember I came into my first day in the office in Darfur and I opened the refrigerator to get, thinking that I was going to get a nice cold glass of water. And I drank this janjaweed juice, which, you know, comes out tasting like paint thinner. And I almost like puked right there. So it's you know, Darfur is dry country, so we had to make do with what we could find. So it was locally made.
Darfur was your second place after Rwanda.
Yes.
My guest is Jessica Alexander. She's written a book called Chasing Chaos: My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid. How does humanitarian aid work affect one's relationship with the people back home?
Well, I write about this a lot, and, you know, the out of humanitarian aid part of the title speaks to the difficulties I've had, you know, sometimes coming back when it was very difficult to reacclimate.
The culture shock was reverse culture shock?
Yeah, because at least you're not part of the culture in these places, but you're certainly part of a subculture and the other expats you can identify with and relate to. Whereas when I came back, I got, you know, some really absurd comments and questions from my friends, but I could understand their, you know, curiosity and their lack of understanding because I was just like them. And so part of the purpose of this book was to really expose who aid workers are and what we do.
Didn't you break off your engagement in order to pursue this career?
I wouldn't say it was in order to pursue this career. There were other circumstances involved.
But it also sounds like it's hard to maintain a normal social life because you're in such isolated circumstances, and sometimes the pressures are so powerful.
And also you're leading a transient lifestyle, and so maintaining any connections in one place that you're just going to leave in the next one is very difficult. I've had a number of friendships and even romances that have died because the next emergency happens and you have to go there.
Do you feel that you achieved something palpable in Rwanda? Or the group you were working with?
Again, you know, not necessarily Rwanda. I was just an intern. I mean, I did what I was told and hopefully contributed to a larger system that was making a difference. I mean, people were relocated. People were getting back to their families, largely in part because the humanitarian aid was helping them. So me, myself, I did my small little job that hopefully contributed to a larger response.
And then you went, as we said, to Darfur. Did you have a bigger job there?
Yeah. And there I was thrown into a really big job, actually, not by choice, but as many times happens in these places, you know, staff turnover is quite high for whatever reason, and you're thrown into a job, and it's either sink or swim. So there I was managing a camp of 24,000 internally displaced people.
And you kind of get involved with the people you're working with.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I was part
of that. They adopted you in a way?
Well, you know, part of that role was I didn't actually do anything except mediate between the camp community and the aid community and sort of be the in-between of messages. And so in doing so, I really, you know, relied on the local leaders of the camp to tell me what the issues were, tell me what, you know, needed to be fixed or addressed in the camp so that I could relay that back.
Well, Darfur is still a troubled area.
It is, yeah.
Because it didn't become independent when the rest of South Sudan became independent?
Well, South Sudan, that's a totally different conflict. So Darfur is part of North Sudan, mm-hmm. but, I mean, it's a different
But that was the area context. That we heard most, we heard about conflict most.
Right.
And then in the end, when independence was declared, it was another part of the country.
Right.
Didn't the elders insist on calling your father when you told them that you were leaving? Did they want to tell him?
They did. Well, again, you know, I did make some relationships or strong bonds with some of these guys because I really cared and listened to what they were saying and tried to relay these messages as best I could back to the aid community. And so when I told them that I was leaving, they actually pulled out their phone to call my dad to tell him that I should stay.
So and they spoke to him in Arabic, and he thought.
I gave the phone to my staff who spoke English, actually, and yeah.
My guest is Jessica Alexander, who has spent much of the last decade in dealing with various humanitarian crises across the globe. She's written a book called "Chasing Chaos: My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid." It is published by Broadway Books. We'll continue our conversation, find out some of the problems that humanitarian aid faces after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Jessica Alexander, who has written a book called Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid. It's published by Broadway Books. People sometimes criticize humanitarian aid corporations or organizations for not addressing corruption in the areas that they're working. Did you have any experience with this while you were working in the field?
I saw a few instances, but I think, you know, we're very quick to pick up when it does happen. But in the majority of cases, it's not as blatant as perhaps the media makes it. I mean, there were times where I know we gave a finance officer, for example, tens of thousands of dollars to carry out to the field. And he was driven to the airport, watched get on the plane, and, you know, the staff was going to pick him up at the next, you know, where he was supposed to get off. And lo and behold, he was nowhere to be found. But, you know, this stuff happens. But I think, again, we're introducing a lot of resources to a place where they don't have much. So it can happen.
But you're also dealing with dictatorships, with corrupt local officials, and you have to navigate through some pretty complicated situations.
Sure. And certainly that happened after the Haiti earthquake. I mean, in one anecdote that I put in the book, you know, one of the problems was getting just our vehicles out of the ports. And there was this theory that, you know, we all had to then rent cars because our fleet was stuck in the ports because it wouldn't get registered. And there was this theory that, you know, well, they were taking their sweet time registering our vehicles because the rental companies were giving kickbacks to the guys who were supposed to be registering. And so there was just this cycle of nothing happening because no one had the incentive to just get our vehicles out.
There are also charges that the money doesn't always go to the people who need it most.
Well, I think that that's a charge that I have some issue with. I mean, agencies spend money on overhead because these are really logistically heavy projects that are time sensitive and require a lot of management. And so when you say don't go to the people who need it most, I mean, yes, your money may be going to feeding a family, but it also may be going to fuel for a generator to keep the electricity on so we can work on our computers. And donors, when they're giving money, should be okay with either of those outcomes because both are extremely important.
Then there's always the matter of putting people into danger. Doctors Without Borders goes into some of the scariest places in the world, and sometimes they have to take their people out because they are under threat of being killed. In fact, they sometimes are killed.
Sure. I mean, we just saw this in Syria with 7 aid workers from the ICRC kidnapped. So part of the funding, too, is to keep staff safe, and that costs money as well. And, we're being asked to go into some very dangerous situations.
Did you ever fear for your life?
I didn't, no. I was never in a situation where I feared. The only fear is, you know, from being on an airplane that was like rickety and you didn't know if it was going to fall from the sky, or being on a really terrible road and you're like, I can't see out of this windshield. I'm sure this driver can't see out of this windshield.
But soldiers never held you at a roadblock or anything like that?
I mean, I had to pass through roadblocks, but it was never a confrontational situation, no.
After you left Darfur, you traveled to Southeast Asia in response to the tsunami in 2004.
Yeah.
But you didn't go there as an aid worker in the traditional sense, rather as a consultant. Had you risen up the NGO hierarchy?
I don't think so. I mean, a consultant versus a program manager versus a technical expert, we're all, you know, I would say consultant is probably lower than those people with actual expertise. I mean, now I've been doing a lot of evaluations, but we're all sort of at the same level.
But this is quite different from your experience in Africa.
Sure. I was, you know, I had to come in with more of a critical eye and evaluate the agency that I was hired by its work, and with a team. I mean, I wasn't just by myself.
Were you just moving from one agency to another? Is there an employment agency that, or do you go to the internet and look up NGOs crisis?
You go on ReliefWeb, which is, a site that has a lot of listings for NGOs. I mean, yeah, some people have careers for a very long time in one agency. That hasn't been my path. I've had a number of different jobs and for different agencies, UN and NGOs.
So far, you've talked about situations where there wasn't much money. But after the tsunami, aid organizations were flooded with donations. What is it about that disaster that attracted so much more money and attention than many others that are probably equally destructive?
Sure. Well, that's a great point. I mean, to answer your question first, though, it's, you know, it happened right around Christmas time, so people were already in a giving mode. it was blasted all over the TV, and these images of, you know, very innocent victims being swept up by water were hard to ignore. And so there were blameless victims. It's much harder to fundraise for a crisis that involves a conflict where there's a good and a bad. And, you know,
and Westerners were also dying.
Exactly, yeah. And so there were a lot of English-speaking people who could speak to the tragedy, who were there at the time and speaking to the generosity of the locals and how much these people needed help. So that certainly helped. But, you know, there's this thing called the CNN effect, which is there's not a disaster unless the media is there. And the media was everywhere after the tsunami.
You say that all that money can sometimes be a bad thing.
Well, what I was talking about there is, you know, money equating stuff. And really well-intentioned Americans gave a ton of money and stuff, though, that, you know, is
clothes and medicine.
Clothes and medicine, but clothes that were sometimes really inappropriate, like Santa costumes, 4-inch high heels, and party dresses. And also,
should they have been sending saris?
Well, I think they should have been sending money instead to agencies who were there who could have. Who know what the local needs are. A lot of times the clothes weren't needed. You know, people were able to clothe themselves. What were needed were water facilities, were temporary shelters, things that, you know, we often assume we know what the needs are from afar, but really the agencies there have a better idea of what can be locally resourced and therefore more cost effective and also more appropriate to the situation.
So what happens to all of those jeans and 4-inch heel shoes and well, T-shirts?
They were disposed of or they laid on the side of the street in a lot of cases. And that costs money, too, to dispose of these things. And unused medicines, like everything from like Neosporin to Preparation H to Viagra was sent. And that, you know, can be dangerous if you can't read the labels and these medicines also expire and need to be disposed of as well.
In some cases, the expiration dates had been covered up.
Yeah, that can happen.
So people just dumping the stuff that they had.
Right, and turning that into, you know, these gifts in kind, into a translating that into a so-called monetary donation, which sounds like you're giving a lot, but you're really giving unusable stuff.
Is there something charities can do to channel those sympathies in a more productive way?
Sure. And, you know, these are really human impulses and ones that should be commended and encouraged and not discouraged. But, you know, again, I think the best thing that people can do is learn about the context and what the actual needs are, not what they think the needs are, because oftentimes it's very different. And find a charity that's transparent, that can identify the needs and publicize those needs and also explain how they're responding to those needs. And then give to money to those organizations.
My guest is Jessica Alexander. Her book, Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid, is published by Broadway Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ledit Lopate. And then in 2006, you traveled to Sierra Leone.
Yeah.
Did you just want to keep on going out of the frying pan and into the fire?
Well, Sierra Leone, the conflict had ended then, and it was in a what we call a post-crisis development stage. And so it wasn't
really... No more blood diamonds?
No more blood diamonds. That phase had ended. But the special court for Sierra Leone was there, and they were prosecuting the people who were part of that war.
So it was your job to help collect evidence for the trial of Charles Taylor?
I sort of fell upon that job really fortuitously, and it was one of the best, you know, career things that had happened. I was there on a Fulbright, actually, researching former child soldiers and life outcomes, and the prosecution team was having a difficult time finding witnesses who could speak to just the number of children who were abducted in the war. And I was friends with a bunch of the people there, and so they asked me to write a report just documenting what had happened based on my research.
Have you been following the trial?
Well, I know that Charles Taylor is now his sentence was upheld. He might have gotten off, but now he'll be behind bars for 50 years.
And you write that while you were in Sierra Leone, your personal and professional lives genuinely merged.
Mm.
In what way?
Well, you know, in Darfur, which is where I had just come from, and had a really tough time with in this decision. I wasn't even going to go to Sierra Leone because I had had a really tough time there just with my personal life. It was very isolating, and I didn't know whether I was cut out for it. But in Sierra Leone—
Were you getting homesick?
It wasn't homesick necessarily. It was sick. It was company sick. You know, it was sick for having a phone connection, having an internet connection to be able to just talk to people and connect with people. You're surrounded by really challenging issues. Then it's sometimes important to connect with those that you love, and it was difficult to do from there.
Yesterday we talked about war correspondents. We have a number of times in the past about why they continually go to the most dangerous places in the world.
Yeah.
Do you see something similar in the kind of work that you were doing?
I do. I mean, I think, you know, we joke about the aid junkies or the, you know, disaster enthusiasts. And there is an adrenaline rush when an emergency happens and you're gearing up to go because, you know, it's part of being an aid worker is having an adventurous spirit. And so we're drawn to this kind of work because of that. But I think, you know, at a certain point, you can get burnt out if you just keep going without a pause.
And you did. You went 2010 to Haiti, as you mentioned earlier, in the aftermath of the earthquake there. Was your experience there different from what you'd had in Africa and Southeast Asia?
I think well, there I was, you know, a bit more seasoned, and so I knew what I was getting into, for better or worse. And also the proximity to the U.S., it didn't feel as far. And there was a huge aid effort there, and so it was really exciting to be there at the early stages of the crisis.
Well, we've heard all sorts of awful things about what happened there. In fact, now there's also a cholera epidemic as a result of humanitarian aid. Was that crisis handled well?
Well, I was there when cholera hit Haiti, and I just remember all of us sitting around thinking, oh, my gosh, we're already putting in 120% effort. How can we now respond to another crisis? And I think it was handled well. It's tragic that cholera was introduced to Haiti, and certainly there have been many thousands of lives lost. But the response was, you know, fast, and they're still working to treat people. And if we hadn't been there, you know, just to respond, I think it would have been a lot worse.
Well, there are all sorts of problems that we've heard about. People who have been left homeless, there was a lot of sexual abuse. Can somebody like you deal with those things and make them better?
You mean from aid workers?
Yes, aid workers being told that a woman is in a camp is being raped, for example.
My agency can, yeah. I mean, I'm not a reproductive health specialist, but certainly, yeah, there are staff on the ground who are prepared and have expertise in dealing with those kinds of things, certainly.
Now, you've also worked in international humanitarian situations in an office in New York. Mm. Did that feel kind of too easy?
It just feels kind of removed from the action that's happening. I think it's important, if you are working in New York, to have had that field experience because you can bring that to the bureaucratic global level. But yeah, it's definitely on a much slower pace. And again, you know, just very distant from the realities that are happening in these countries that are facing real challenges.
Well, what do you hope people will understand about what you've done after having read your book?
I hope they understand more about humanitarian aid, how it works, how these massive operations are extremely complex, and we're working under extremely challenging situations. And, you know, this book isn't academic. I wanted to make it as accessible as possible so that people really can understand from one person's perspective what happens. And I have a lot of experiences over a range of countries. And so I just wanted to give a taste to people of what it's like. But I also wanted to, as we had just discussed, you know, explain a bit about how they can help and how they can be involved. And sometimes that means, you know, staying home and supporting agencies that are there and do have expertise.
And helping appropriately rather than sending those old high heels that you don't need anymore.
Exactly, yes.
Jessica Alexander's book is Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid. It's published by Broadway Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.